Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 115 of Registry Matters. Larry, it is a Saturday night. We have a guest again. It's as if this person is going to join us on a regular basis, but he's Mr. Michigan. So, Larry, meet Josh. Josh, meet Larry. I don't think you guys have ever spoken before.
Hey, Larry.
Well, welcome aboard, Josh. Looking forward to talking to you, but I didn't expect it to be the following week.
I know,
yeah, right? I told Andy he should apologize to everyone in advance for me being your guest again.
To which I replied, I have to apologize to them every week for Larry, so it's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. How was your Saturday, Larry? You went and did more party stuff, right?
Yeah, and that's going to be the thing for the next few weeks. I'll be doing party stuff the next weekend, and then 2 weekends later, and then again at some point after that.
So I'll just tell everybody now that we're going to record next Sunday, I believe it is, in the afternoon. So we won't be on time next week.
Well, there's a possibility we might if the meetings go and if they're well managed and we don't go too long. But you never know. Today it went pretty well.
And I guess we can dive right into this. So the big news came out yesterday that the federal judge, I hope I'm going to word this right, the federal judge announced that everything should be shot down in Michigan, something like that. Somebody give me some better pointers on what happened yesterday in Michigan. Josh?
That's pretty much it. I mean, there were, you know, he basically decided on our side on every issue, with the exception that the Michigan court, I mean, that the decision doesn't actually go into effect until more or less 90 days from now if the legislator doesn't act to make the current statute into a new statute that's constitutionally permissible. That's probably Larry, the easiest way I can.
Okay. And Larry, do you have anything to counter with that?
That's essentially what the judge said. The timing is a little bit different than the 90 days. It'll be 60 days from the entry of judgment. And the parties are going to be negotiating to word the judgment, the final judgment of the court. And then the legislature will again have an opportunity to legislate. And their incentive has just gone up exponentially from where it was. So we're going to dig into that a little bit later. But as it existed, the status quo, with all the previous litigation on this, there had been no change to the Michigan Registry except for the five original does that won. They were the only ones who had gotten any relief. And this class action suit that was filed subsequently, this has been dangling for some time. And now the judge has forced the issue, and we'll explain to it why, because the reason why there was no incentive, because if the status quo was being maintained, there's very little incentive to legislate. So the opportunity that they were given previously, they declined that opportunity because the political risk, in their view, was too great. Now the political risk has shifted. They're too great for them not to legislate. So now they may be able to legislate something in the time frame that they have.
Yeah, I mean, the tricky part of it is that there's essentially two different parts of the issue at hand. There's the all the people who are ex post facto, which at the time would have been I believe it's April of 2011, it's going to be much harder to create a constitutionally permissible registry that isn't ex post facto for all the different groups of people who are prior to, who are under different statutes prior to that date. That's consistent with all the people after the date. So it gets kind of confusing as to how they would actually, I mean, one way they could do it is just to go back to, in essence, like a Does versus Alaska style registry, where whatever the original version of the registry was is really what the registry becomes. I don't know what you think about that, Larry, but what a constitutionally permissible registry that encompassed both groups would be.
Oh, it's very easy. Don't impose any disabilities or restraints, and you've got a constitutional registry until we fully develop the fact that being on the internet itself is a violation of the Constitution, which we're moving in that direction. But if you want a constitutional registry, do not try to impose any disabilities or restraints. Let people live where they want. let them work where they want, let them be where they want, and minimize the inconvenience and intrusion in their life as minimally as we possibly can, which would be mail reporting, online reporting, and then you would have a constitutional registry until we prove that merely listing people's likeness online is punishment. But they haven't asked me to help them draft a constitutional registry, but I'd be delighted to do that. But most people on the law enforcement side would not like the registry that I would draft, because it would be permissible. We would register people just like we do young men for the draft.
Honestly, I've heard over and over again that, at least in the stakeholder meetings, that the Michigan State Police are actually not fans at all, really, of the registry. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, let's cover some stuff before we get into that whole thing in Michigan with your Upper Peninsula and all that. We got I'm introducing a new segment here, and it's called Larry's General Rules of Criminality. This is developed over a long period of time. Larry calls me on the phone and he tells me these stories about, hey, don't drive 95 miles an hour down the interstate with bags with drugs in it that says drugs are here. So we have another article that we can cover talking about what you shouldn't do as a criminal if you're going to commit crimes. Not that we're advocating for committing crimes. Larry, please tell us, what is the latest rules of criminality that you want to, what am I trying to say, to like aspire to our people?
Yeah, where does this one come from? I didn't catch the jurisdiction. This is
Convicted Killers, Jimmy Ray Rogers. Let's see, where are they from? Oh, they're from Missouri. The article comes from CBS News, but the individuals originated in Missouri for their trek down to Florida.
Okay, so we've got Florida and Missouri involved. What I'm stressing is, don't commit crimes, but people inevitably are going to commit crimes, and then they're going to need defense attorneys. And you make our job a lot harder when you do things like this. If you're going to pick out a person and target them for death, and you need to travel across the country from Missouri to Florida, please don't use the GPS device in the rental car to the final destination of the person you're going to kill. Now, I would prefer you don't kill them. But if you do find it necessary that you must, for whatever your reasons are, we're going to have a lot harder time if you've done that, because that's what these people did.
And then they end up on camera in a Walmart picking up supplies for said activities?
For the cleanup, yeah, for the which in most states will get you for tampering with evidence and trying to conceal the crime. But just, that's another FYI as a side point for this. Every public place now has video. And when you use your little debit card because you're so proud you don't carry any cash with you, it makes it very easy to identify you, because most of those pretty plastic cards, the banks and financial institutions have taken great pains to make sure they belong to you. Now, there are exceptions for prepaid cards, but usually your fancy card that makes you feel so happy that you're not carrying cash because you don't want to be vulnerable, it actually makes you quite vulnerable.
I can, like, happily attest that I have no cash in my house.
Oh, I understand. And that's the way the society, only about a quarter to last stats I saw of transactions in America are being done by cash anymore.
Even a quarter? 25% of transactions are still done by cash?
Yes, but it varies from location. In a place like where I live, it would be even higher, because there's a lot of unbanked people here. But in a place that's more affluent and where there's less of a diverse population, you'd probably see even lower than 25% of people that are conducting their business with cash. But yes, when you're at the local market, wherever it is, if you take notice, there's cameras everywhere, there's screens everywhere. And when you slide your card, it links the card to you. So when you buy the cleanup stuff to destroy the evidence of the crime, you've just recorded yourself buying the cleanup stuff. So just keep that in mind.
Larry, I just had an idea, because we were talking pre-show about how did they attribute these two individuals to the crime. Maybe they left something at the crime scene of, you know, a Clorox wipe or whatever the hell, and then they looked at recent transactions and they're like, oh, hey, look, these people bought these things at the local Walmart. Like, maybe that's how they put it together.
Not real clear on that, but you can just take some steps in advance to try to minimize. In this high tech era, that's one reason the crime rate in this country has dropped so much, is because the solvability of criminality. If you go back 150 years, they solved crimes by eyewitnesses. Someone had to, when you had Jack the Ripper on the loose, you had to go out and actually catch him doing the crime, because you couldn't go back after the fact. and figure out what happened. But as forensics have evolved and technology has evolved and social media has evolved, there's so much that solves crimes now that we couldn't have even fathomed 25, 30 years ago. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, Larry's right. The crime rate is down for a lot of reasons. That's certainly one of them, is that it's much harder to get away with crime now. And, you know, this is a great demonstration of why. Every single data point, every place you go, everything you do, you're leaving a digital trail behind. And, you know, I mean, it just takes the right person to put the parts together, and then you're pretty much cooked. And that's what happened here.
So, A, don't go around killing people, but B, don't put the address in the GPS, and probably maybe buy supplies maybe en route and not at the destination. I don't know. Maybe buy them at home 2 weeks before.
And maybe use cash.
And use cash, of course. And maybe put a hat on and some sunglasses when you walk into these stores, so you're not really that easily identified.
Because then they've got to still, even if you use cash, that's not foolproof, because facial recognition, it will get you. So they would run your video of you, they would freeze it, and they would run that through facial recognition. And if you're in the driver's license or the state ID database, it would throw out a number of potential hits, and they would still get you. So it's really difficult these days. You killing people's not as easy as it once was.
I have a potential solution to the facial recognition thing, considering it's sort of in vogue to wear a mask across your face because of the coronavirus that has killed, 1,400 or something people. Just as a side note, in 2017, there were like 60,000 people that died from our normal annual flu season. So the coronavirus probably isn't as significant an ordeal. But anyway, so wear a face mask, and it would be sort of culturally accepted at the moment. Throw on some sunglasses. Facial recognition will never work.
So, but preferably just don't commit the crime. That would be the best solution. Don't go around committing crimes. But if you're going to commit crimes, you're going to need people to defend you, because otherwise the system will just railroad you and chew you alive.
In this case, they wouldn't have been railroaded. They
sort of handed the case to them on a silver platter, right?
Well, they committitted the crime.
Well, yeah, there's not that really too. Railroading. Yeah. Really, the segue to our next article. Go ahead and finish your point, Larry.
Well, the question is, there may not be any doubt about the crime, but there's the question of culpability in terms of, were there more than one person? Was there more than one person involved? How culpable was the second, third person compared to the person who actually did the dirty deed? Some states don't apply an accessory, and some states is just as culpable and responsible, but in other states they're not. And then the question is it a premeditated first degree murder? Is it eligible for life in prison without parole? Is there mitigation that would diminish the possibility of getting life without parole, make it life with option for? I mean, there's a lot of things defense attorneys can do. Just because they've got you for the crime doesn't mean that there's no defenses that would help mitigate the outcome.
Oh, I agree with that.
Which I think is a fairly decent segue into the second article that we're going to cover, is from the Baltimore Sun. It's "When Innocent People Go to Prison, Jailhouse Informants Are Often to Blame. Some Maryland lawmakers want to change that system." And if I remember right, looking through these stats, something of, was it a sixth or a seventh of the, so nearly one in five of the 367 DNA-based exoneration cases nationally have occurred because they've been let go because of false testimony from jailhouse informants, which goes to, I mean, that's a, to me, so that's like 70 something people that have been let go after false testimony from a jailhouse informant.
Yeah, boy, that's shocking that the jailhouse informants aren't telling the truth. I have hard time.
I know, right?
Well,
I'm not surprised about it, but it's like, but the system encourages it. And Larry, you can speak much more, more informatively on this than I can, but like, you know, they're rewarded for it. They're incentivized for doing it. And that would obviously give them a reason to not tell the truth if they're going to get some curried favor.
Therein lies the problem, Andy. And I try not to deliberately straddle the fence, because I do have my opinions. Also try to give credit for difficult positions that people find themselves in on the other side. A prosecutor is in a difficult position, particularly when crimes of a heinous nature are not solved. there's a demand from the community. So the prosecutor's office is under scrutiny to do something. So they're looking for solutions and convictions and ways to close the case. The problem rests with the trade-off of what happens. You're not generally, as a prosecutor, you're not going to build your case around people. You wouldn't go to the local parsonage, and you're not going to find the people that are going to be able to help you solve that crime, likely in the congregation. The people that are going to have more information are probably going to be a little bit on the shady side. So that relegates you to having to deal with those kind of people. The question becomes, what do you give those kind of people in return? And it's a very, very awkward position to be in, because if you evaluate the snitch's information, and it seems credible, the snitch, of course, wants something. They've got 14 years to do in prison, and they'd like to reduce that down. So I'll help you if you help me. The prosecutor ends up having to deal with these kind of people. My objection is that a system that's built around snitching and rewards, where that is what's encouraged versus it just happening. If a person in prison can't tolerate a cellmate or what do you call it, with the unit, with the whole unit, the housing unit, if there's some gross individual that's done a bunch of awful things, and they just want it to be known in the interest of justice, because that's who they are, even though they're in prison, and they want to help the administration of justice, that's one thing. But if they come and say, hey, I have got this magic evidence for you, and I want something in exchange, that is a perverse incentive. That's kind of like policing for profit. I mean, it's not the same thing, but it's kind of like policing for profit. The profit for them is they get released early. And that encourages, in my view, untrue accusations and testimony. And that's what worries me.
I wouldn't say, I mean, for me, it's not just worrisome, and I appreciate Larry's kindness to prosecutors, but, you know, I think in many of these cases that they're outright willing to manufacture evidence, or, you know, at least plausibly, with some plausible deniability, manufacture evidence in order to ensure a conviction. And a lot of times they don't really care if the conviction is legitimate or not. You know, I mean, I think probably the most famous case of this right now is the Amy Klobuchar incident, where back when she was the prosecutor of Hennepin County, she put someone who was a juvenile away for a case where a young girl had been shot. And it turns out that the two pieces of evidence that convicted this kid were were paid in jailhouse informants. And when, you know, later when she's asked about it all these years later, she says, well, of course you should put new evidence out. If there's new evidence, they should put it out and get this person out. But the question isn't a question of new evidence. It's a question of new reporting about old evidence. And it's the evidence her office used to convict, you know, this plays out in real life all the time and in very disturbing ways. And, you know, I mean, there's a really good book by Emily Bazelon about kind of all the ways in which prosecutors are incentivized in a lot of ways, in a lot of poor ways, and ends up in a lot of miscarriages of justice, and sometimes I would say bad faith miscarriages of justice.
I don't agree with you. I don't disagree with you. I mean, meant to say I don't disagree with you. It would be ideal if all prosecutors carried the highest level of ethical conduct and adhered to that, but they don't. They're wanting convictions because that's the pressure they're under. How do we change the system that we have now where, without fail, almost all prosecutors in the country at the state level have to be elected by the people, and the people are being constantly told that crime is out of control and this person's not doing anything about it, and they could be putting more people away if they weren't so pro-defendant? And, of course, prosecutors are generally not pro-defendant, but they're under enormous pressure to close cases. So assume the prosecutor is not unethical, but they're still face these pressures. How do we alleviate and take some of this pressure off to gain convictions? The unethical ones we'll have to deal with in another way. But how do we relieve the pressure that they feel from the public?
It sure would be nice if the media would stop reporting that crime's out of control all the time, when it's actually, you know, arguably the lowest it's been since like 1967. But aside from that, you know, I mean,
I bumped an article to next week talking from the New York Times that, it was from the appeal challenging that the New York Times was saying that the crime is running rampant based on like some of the bond changes. But then the appeal's like, no, it's actually down. Here's the actual numbers. Stop reporting BS.
Mm-hmm. The appeal is right.
And I've maintained on for the history of this podcast, I've been saying that crime, I've said it when I had eggs thrown at me at a NARSL conference in Atlanta back in 2016.
You had somebody that wanted to perform an exorcism on you on the spot. It was almost like I don't remember who it was. Who stood up in State of the Union address where he said, "You lie when Obama said something." I forgot what it was.
Yeah, that was about the Affordable Care Act, yes. But
yes. Somebody goes, "You lie!"
Of course, there was no retribution. There was no reprisal. There was no punishment. There was nothing really of any significance that happened on that. But crime has been trending down for a very long time across the country with pockets of exceptions. And because I'd love to have that debate about what we do about the media, because every proposal I come up with is not acceptable. And it's kind of like, okay, well, do we reinstitute the fairness doctrine? No. Do we break up these media Goliaths where they have so much ownership and their primary obligation, and rightfully so in a capitalist system, is to return dollars to their shareholders and to enhance the value of their shares? How do we deal with this? Because nobody wants to fund public broadcasting. That's communist and socialist. No one wants to limit what can be aired. No one wants to require equal time. And no one wants to break up the monopolies that control the bulk of what we hear. So I'm all ears for suggestions. What do we do about the media? Because they're doing what they do. They're trying to make profits for their shareholders. That's the capitalist system.
I mean, there was the thing we covered recently where the prosecutors, I think that was in New York, where they didn't want to have an independent review panel.
Well, independent review panels are usually run by other attorneys, which means that they don't do a particularly great job at punishing attorneys. They're usually not independent, but it's still something. You know, I mean, we've seen that with Brady evidence and other things, but I don't know. It's the question of media that Larry was asking just a second ago. I feel like, you know, I've spent a good deal of the last couple of years, in essence, trying to get people to join in calling out the media every time they make bad arguments about crime, about sex crimes, about all kinds of stuff. And sometimes that's been pretty effective, you know, I mean, especially last year when we were, I think I got a group of like 85 formerly incarcerated people to organize around the stake in prison narrative during the federal shutdown. But at other times it hasn't been. I think very recently there was a decent number of people who struck back against that one news outlet that was talking about, I can't remember what the story was, but it was a sex crime thing or a registration. Oh, it was people who were rounded up for registration or something like that. I mean, I just think we have to, you know, use the tools we have just to talk back to the media and to bring attention to the fact that they aren't being factually correct or even close to factually correct most of the time.
Okay, but why are they obligated to be factually correct other than morally? They're in a business and they're selling a product. Why? Unless we're going to have the government come in and say that you have to be accurate in your stories, why? What obligates them to be factually accurate or even balanced and show both sides of an issue? Why? Why do they have to do that?
I don't think they do have to do that. I think that we can ask them to do that and say when they don't do that, that, you know, and call attention to when they don't do that. It's ultimately up to the consumers what, you know, they decide to do with the media. But, you know, we have to use the tools at our disposal to try to counter the bad narratives that they put out there. You know, I don't think I called for any legislation or anything like that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But without legislation, I'm sorry, but guts and sensationalism sells. If you put on fluffy news, that doesn't sell. We are in this predicament because this is what the public wants to consume.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I hate to get into too much of an argument here, but so, Yeah, we probably lost this battle about 2 months ago or maybe a month and a half ago. It all runs together. I was really involved in pushing back against the bail reform backlash in New York City. I got called in to help. I wrote some talking points. I did a bunch of pushback on social. And while, you know, they were much better organized than we were to start out with, we still, you know, I was still getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of people reading the pushback every single day. And, you know, I mean, that maybe, you know, maybe a million people go the other way. But I mean, I still feel like it can be very effective if you learn how to do messaging and you work with other people who share the same goals to push back against the media. At least you get a lot of people who become better informed, which I think is hopefully the goal of a lot of this stuff.
Well, I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that the media is a part of the problem, but I don't know how we solve it.
This next article comes from The Appeal that talks about new data suggests risk assessment tools have little impact on pre-trial incarceration. What jumped out at me in this, and I'll give you my own little personal spin on it, is I've written something of like a machine learning algorithm to detect for fraudulent orders. But one of the things that I do with it is I feed new data into it to validate whether the, like, hey, this is what I told you might be fraudulent. So can you tell me whether it actually was fraudulent? So that way it keeps learning and modifying the system as it goes. But these people, these you people, as it were, they created some system to evaluate people up front, whether they could be released pre-trial, but then they don't feed any data back into it, whether they were right, whether the people that they released or not released, whether they committed, obviously, if they were still detained, they weren't committing much for crimes. But if they were released, whether they whether the prediction was accurate or not, that bothers me.
Well, okay, it bothers you.
I can't do anything about it, but I just want, that was the point that jumped out at me. And I know that you're going to have all kinds of, if you're not guilty of anything, why are you having all these disabilities and restraints? Why are you having all those things put on you if you're innocent until proven guilty?
Well, that is where I'm going to go with this. And then Josh is going to counter with some of the pre-show banter that we had. But I have a lot of trepidation. I totally understand and agree with those who have money under the cash bail system. If you have structured preset bail for a list of offenses, and that's the way it was largely done up until recently in most jurisdictions, as you got charged with a fourth degree felony, well, it's a $1,500 bond for a fourth degree felony. Well, if you have $1,500, that doesn't magically make you a better person as far as moral character and do you have the likelihood of appearing in court. And depending on how many $1,500 collections you have, it might be very easily that you could absorb the loss of the $1,500 and still not show up in court. So I understand all of those arguments. No one needs to regurgitate them to me. But where I break with those people is, although that system has many flaws, it was fast and expedient, and those who did have the resources, like with everything else in a capitalist system, those who have the resources can have the nice car, the nice colleges, all these things. The person who had the resources would be able to exit the jail faster. But since you're presumed innocent, that's exactly what should be happening. Is you should be exiting the jail as quickly as possible after you've been booked. And after there has been some reasonable assurance that you will participate in the process, because that's what you're supposed to do when you're accused, is participate in the process. So the question becomes, how do we make sure people will participate in the process? I'm still on board with bail reform if that's all it's for, but that's not what the reformists have done. They've not only wanted to assure that you'll participate in the process and continue to go about your life under the presumption of innocence, they've decided that this is a chance where we can rehab you. Of course, you're not guilty of anything yet. You may be charged with a DWI, but you've not been convicted. You may very well not be guilty of whatever that charge is. So therefore, I don't feel we're in the rehabilitation business or the restraint business until there's either a plea or an adjudication of some sort of guilt, which there's where I break with them, because they come in with all these conditions. They said, we'll let you out of jail. You ain't going to have to post no money, but we got this neat little thing here. It's a GPS monitor, and it has a separator in it, and you get to blow in it all night long when it goes off. And you have to go to DWI. You have to go to alcohol counseling every week. You still may not be guilty of any problem. And you have to, all these conditions you have to do, and you have to even in some jurisdictions pay for the privilege of being monitored pre-trial at some level. And there's where I break with them. I don't like that system. And also the delay of the tool, how long it takes the tool to be, to evaluate, and whatever it is that's evaluating you on. Well, they now decide your propensity to commit another crime. Well, you haven't been found guilty of this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the difference is, first of all, that with most of the tools, you know, that it's the point isn't necessarily rehabilitation. It's a question of dangerousness. And the algorithm basically uses a bunch of, depending on which algorithm you use, uses a bunch of hopefully dynamic data instead of static data to try to determine your level of dangerousness of committing a new crime while you're on bond or whatever. And, you know, those, some of those things may seem rehabilitative, but they're justified under dangerousness. You know, I mean, traditionally, the two big problems with risk assessments are, one, that they tend to, in a lot of cases, create particularly racially discriminatory outcomes. And the second one is, as, you know, Larry was just mentioning, that a lot of times there's a risk that actually more people get detained under a system with risk assessment than without risk assessment and with cash bail. Now, personally, I'm for a system that tends to err on the side of release on recognizance. You know, we've had bail reform in a bunch of different jurisdictions. We've had bail reform in DC is kind of where a lot of this started. You've got New Jersey, you've got Philadelphia, you've got Cook County, Illinois, you've got Kentucky, and you've got, I'm probably leaving someone out, but that's a lot of them. And in all of those places, the big fears of bail reform are that crime will increase. That's actually not been true. Crime's decreased and recidivism has decreased. And failure to appear is the other thing that people get really freaked out about. And in all those places, appearance rates have been about the same. And so the kind of terror stories about bail reform, I don't really believe are true. I tend to believe that you always should err on the side of liberty. And so I believe people are innocent until proven guilty. And so when people, you know, I was out, you know, when I was arrested, I got bailed out. I was lucky enough to have the money to do that. And despite the, you know, the charges that I faced, I seemed to have made it to trial okay and went to prison. You know, I think that's the way it works for most people. And I think that, that there's a reason for that. And I think everybody should be afforded the right to, you know, there's a lot of bad outcomes from pretrial detention. You're more likely to be found guilty. You're more likely to commit future crimes. It's just not a very good public safety policy, and it hasn't had very good outcomes. And bail reform on the whole has had pretty good outcomes. Now, I also think that we should err on the side of liberty. And so I'm not a huge fan necessarily of risk assessment tools unless they can be proven to not be racially discriminatory and to allow for more, not less release.
How about Charles writes, maybe they should look at other countries instead of being trapped in the American bubble. In England, no cash bail and crime is not crazy.
We can't look at other countries. We're smarter than all the other countries. Charles, I don't know why you don't understand that.
American exceptionalism, right?
That's correct. I agree with practically everything Josh just said on the side of liberty. If we mean what we say about the presumption of innocence, then there's no need for a prediction of dangerousness because the person is presumed innocent, so therefore they couldn't be dangerous.
I like your point, Larry. It almost makes your head explode by when you say it for real, because you're just like, oh, that's right. You're innocent until proven guilty. So the presumption of innocence would be, you know, hand over your passport, but, you know, give them your booking information, name, address, telephone number, all that stuff. And then you go home.
Well, but I believe the primary purpose of conditions of release is to assure participation. So I think it is relevant to look at the participation rate. If that person has 7 bench warrants over the last 5 years for failing to appear, that is a factor that's worthy of consideration because we need you to show up. But we can give this presumption of innocence, but you need to show up. So that's a factor. But what you might have done, what you might have done in the past, if you showed up for trial, you went to prison, and you paid your debt to society, I thought we were about not holding that against you and using that as a predictor. We seem to be talking out of both sides of our mouth. We're claiming that a person who commits a sexual offense magically is not going to commit another sexual offense, and that the recidivism rate is so strikingly low. Then how can we turn around and say, oh, well, you've done this, and therefore we predict you're dangerous because you've done this once or twice already in your last 30 years?
Well, forgive me for throwing this one out there then, because you, the three of us with normal human means, you know, it wouldn't be easy for us to amass the fortunes to go to another country and go flee the system. But, you know, we had articles on Harvey Weinstein. They got all bumped because of Michigan. But somebody with that level of resources could just, hey, I'm just going to go buy the yacht or take the yacht I already have, and off I go, and FYP to you and your system. So what forces a person with those kinds of resources to participate?
Well, and we'll never have a flawless system where people, what would happen in a case like that is that depending on where they went, they would probably be traced down and brought back either legally or illegally, depending on the severity of the accusation that was made against them.
Dog, but bounty hunter.
We can't tell people that you've made a mistake in your life in 1984. Therefore, we decide you're dangerous. Because what they did in 1984 is ancient history. Now, it's sentencing in most jurisdictions. Your past convictions, with very few exceptions, do get taken into consideration. But this is a new crime. And if you listen to the overnight, the red eye radio, each case is supposed to be, according to those guys, evaluated on its merits. So what I'm interested in doing is, when you're charged with a crime, is building up enough of an assurance that you're going to participate. That's my primary concern. Now, I know that I don't speak for the whole system, but I want to make sure that you're going to show up for court and impose as little restraint as possible on your liberties, except for, let's make sure that you're going to participate with us. So that may mean a regular check-in to make sure you haven't left the jurisdiction. And of course, if you leave the jurisdiction and they're not checking in daily, you could be long gone by the time they miss you. I understand all that, but there's no perfect system.
And I just want to reiterate that, you know, most of the research that's been done around this says that failure to appear rates are about the same with or without bail reform.
Well, the bail industry will argue to you that may be true. But they say that they do a vast public service because they have an economic incentive to go out and track these people down because they're on the hook for that money. So therefore, they're freeing up precious law enforcement resources for the bench warrant because they will go out and bring the person in. And that does carry some weight, because if they've got $20,000 at stake that's going to be forfeited in 90 days, they'll put a bounty hunter out looking for that person, and they'll pay that bounty hunter $2,000 to bring that person in.
The insurance covers all that, is my understanding.
Well, that's
they don't
not
have
what
money
they,
at risk. Their own money is not at risk.
Right, but they would be liable for the money. That's just what they testify to in our legislature on a regular basis.
I've had many rounds with the bail industry union. we're not friends.
But that's their argument, and they're not very happy with bail reform.
No.
I think that we are ready to move over to like round two of Michigan. And here we go again. So the judge announced that the whole thing needs to be shot down and the constitutional problems with the registry in Michigan. And all right, round two, ding, 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 go at it.
Well, you can go first, or I'll go first. But this is an extremely complicated case. I had to read this thing twice, Judge Cleland's opinion that was released yesterday, and I think I largely understand it. But I'll do the once over gloss over, and then we'll get into the nuances of why I have trepidation. What's happening here now is that the judge has enjoined the state from enforcing SORNA in its totality against a large group of people, and those people who have convictions date predating 2011. I mean, a conduct. I keep saying, Josh and I keep saying if their conduct predated. Now, what's unclear to me is because he said that the 2006 amendment that would impose the proximity restrictions, that that that's included, but then he said it was moot. So I'm a little confused, and we're going to need some further
just
development.
Just to clarify,
on that.
The proximity is part of the vagueness decision that he did prior to the Sixth Circuit decision that we were talking about last week, and so it's different grounds. I'm pretty sure.
So and then the judge issued an injunction against enforcement of several provisions of people who have been convicted subsequent that are under the enhanced version. He issued an injunction against enforcing a whole litany of things to deal with the current registrant. So basically, anybody who's required to register in Michigan is getting some level of relief from this, because after the judgment is entered on this case, if the legislature doesn't legislate within 60 days from that date, then SORTA is going to be completely abolished for a large group of people, and it's going to be neutered for the rest of the people. So this is going to be a major panic for Michigan legislators to fix. Okay, Josh, tell me what the court said.
No, I think that's largely correct. I hate to be agreeable, but what you said is pretty much what happened. There's a number of ways that this could play out. The state could obviously appeal. That has, I talked to Miriam Aukerman the other day, and I asked this what she thought, and she said she really isn't sure what the state's going to do at this point, which makes sense because they it didn't seem like their heart was fully in fighting this in the first place, in a lot of ways. Another thing that could happen is that the legislature could try to pass, to write a registry that would be constitutional for everybody before or and after 2011. Which would be a pretty basic registry. And, like I think Larry has suggested, it would have no, it wouldn't create any conditions that put people out, et cetera. The third option is that they could, essentially let the everyone 2011 go away, because that's going to be the hardest one for them to write the kind of registry that they support and still remain constitutional, and then try to just do some modifications and keep everyone post 2011 on the registry and as constrained as possible. There's all kinds of things that they could try to do, and then they could just fail to get the legislator could just fail to get the job done in time. And then Larry just said, the whole thing would go away for people who were pre-April of 2011, and it would be a much different registry for everyone after. There's all kinds of things that could happen. We'll see what does happen.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
What do you think, Larry? What are the political ramifications? Here's one of the questions that I'm one of the many. So they've invalidated and they have 60 days to get their act together, and certain people on day 60 or day 61, whichever, they fall off the registry. A, would they go purge the records? And then on day 61, they enact new legislation. Are those people all brought back in? And now they're under a registration scheme again, where they have to go report in again, and it's equally unconstitutional?
Well, that would be one conceivable. Remember, since any law that's passed is presumed constitutional, there's no prejudging by the court. So although Cleland would probably find it problematic if they passed a SORTA that looked a lot like what they have enforced today, they could conceivably do that. Just look at Pennsylvania. That's almost what they did. They could do that. But I would say, yes, that is one of the possibilities. What I think would be more likely a possibility, and folks, please don't send me ugly emails, because I only tell you what I think possibilities are, and I'll weight them. I don't have a crystal ball, I don't have a direct connection to the AG's office of Michigan. I don't know what they're going to do. I just know how to do political analysis. I'm assuming that in this year, 2020, that a portion or all of the Michigan legislature is up for re-election. I'm assuming that without having done the research. If that's the case.
That is correct. Go ahead.
If that's the case, then they are not going to have any political incentive to unravel SORNA. They're just not going to have, politically, this is not a winner for them to figure out how, unless they could put a spin on it that we're somehow protecting the community, but just to make the registry better for the people who would like not to have to comply with it. That's just not a political winning hand. So I don't think that they're going to be looking to come up with a real easy constitutional registry. I think that's a long shot. It's certainly within the realm of possibilities, but I think that the more likely scenario is that since the Attorney General is charged with enforcing and defending the laws of the state of Michigan, this court, what they have done has actually opened up a lot of potential new litigation that hasn't been done yet, because Cleland went beyond what the Sixth Circuit did. He took the liberty to declare unconstitutional again what he had declared unconstitutional, which was largely ignored by the Sixth Circuit in Doe's number one. And they only focused on the ex post facto violation of the 2006 and 2011 amendments. Cleland had found other constitutional deficiencies. So he's reincorporated that into this new class action case that was filed after that case. And so those have not been tested on appeal yet. So if I were the Attorney General, and I was looking for a way to do my job, and I'm not the Attorney General, but I would be looking at, okay, well, I've got this as an appeal. I can appeal Cleland on this. I can appeal Cleland on granting this, determining that it's not severable. And that would buy a bunch of time to get people beyond the election, because in that appeal, you would ask for a stay of the injunction that's going to take effect in 60 days, and you would hope that you could get two or three judges on the Federal Court of Appeals panel to agree with you that until these issues that he decided beyond Doe versus Snyder have been litigated on appeal, and the fact that the state Supreme Court wasn't given a certified question, that would buy them time. You would possibly get a better outcome politically if that were to happen, if you would remove the election, the threat of the politics from this, because once the election cycle is passed, then there is, if you remember, Obama said, let me get reelected and then I'll have more flexibility. That is just the reality of the situation. The lawmakers in Lansing will have a little more flexibility if they can get past the election. Right now is the worst time at all to try to legislate to improve the SORNA from the registrant's perspective.
And the only thing that I'll say there, although I think that certainly is, well, the two things I'll say there. The first one is that, you know, our Attorney General has multiple times made arguments against the registry now. So I don't think that, you know, she could be forced by her situation as being the chief law enforcement officer of the state to defend this. But like I said before, I'm not entirely sure her heart is 100% behind this in the first place. The second thing that is interesting is that the Sixth Circuit didn't decide on those grounds, but they also very clearly said, you know, we weren't hostile to those grounds. The case just, we just reached on different grounds and you should bring those to us again. So they, you know, and we're likely to rule in your favor. They more or less said it was at the very end of the Sixth Circuit decision, which was, pretty surprising that they went that far. And so I think the tea leaves to some extent have been written on this. They were the ones who originally found it unconstitutional in the first place. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't buy them time. So they might be, there might be a reason to do it, even though they know they're probably going to lose. So I don't disagree with what Larry's saying, but I do think that there is at least some chance, a better than zero chance that the AG doesn't bail them out, but maybe she will.
Well, it's supposed to be their job to defend the laws of the state, and we would like for them to do what we'd like them to do when we disagree with something. But since it's presumed constitutional and that hasn't been ruled on yet, that would be the Attorney General's job, is to say the people enacted this, and And until it's thoroughly exhausted on appeal, my position, our position is, state of Michigan, that this is valid law.
It has technically been ruled on before. It just that wasn't the grounds the Sixth Circuit reached.
Right.
But it was ruled on by Cleland in the previous decision.
That's correct. And the state's entitled to one appeal. They could also file another cert petition, which I doubt they would do. But they're entitled to have this. They're entitled to appeal Cleland. And I'm just saying what I think is a better than 50-50 chance that they would do that. But right now, politically, this is a bad time. By the time this is going to be 90 days before. So we add 90 days to the middle of February, where March, April, May. I don't know when Michigan's primary is. I don't keep track of all that. But if candidates haven't had their primary election yet, they don't want to be knocked out in a primary. If they have had their primary by then, they don't want to be knocked out in the November general. And this is the worst time in the world to be trying to do a positive reform. This is a great time to be doing a crackdown reform. So the inclination would be to want to be tough in the eyes of the voters, because that's what the voters are clamoring for on sex offender registration. If you go out and poll,
I mean, just to play devil's advocate, and sorry, but I think that they have an argument to make that whatever they do could be tougher than the alternative, which is to let it lapse. You know, to essentially let the judgment stand.
Which then means in 90 days, the entire thing, everybody prior to 2011, it's just they're off the roster.
They cannot do that. They politically cannot do that. I mean, that's wishful thinking, Josh, to think that they're just going to say, well, we give up.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying is that because they can't say we give up, the legislator can say whatever they do pass is tougher than the alternative. Like, we did this because to save Michigan from the alternative, which was Judge Cleland's ruling.
Now,
they have some political cover.
I agree with you on that. They have political cover to say that we're forced to do something. But you also have an opponent in November is going to say, if you elect me, I will do this rather than that soft stuff that they're doing. And that's the part you're not analyzing.
Let me interject this.
I'm not analyzing it.
So someone who sent me a comment that someone posted on one of the news websites. So I'm going to read what this person wrote. So bear with me. These are not my words. These are not Larry's words. These are not Josh's words. But this person said, and his name is Norbert, which says, "That's right. To hell with the child victims when the constitutional rights of miscreants, perverts are at risk. What a world we're living in. The criminal, again, is getting privileged treatment while his victims are treated merely as so many ciphers. First of all, child molesters should never breathe free air again, but instead be in prison for the rest of their natural or unnatural lives. Secondly, anyone convicted of murdering a child should definitely face execution. As I've stated many times before in response to these measures to protect and enable these scum, they are a malignancy that has no cure except prison and or execution. Just as a cancer, they should face total and complete removal from our society." I only say that on the heels of the politics side of this discussion, that the public at large is pretty in favor of these kind of laws.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
And to Larry's point of the political risk of the legislature, like letting it all lapse and saying, well, we lost and we'll just go home and, you know, we'll go work on driver's license issues or something like that.
Yeah. But my argument wasn't that they would ever let it lapse. My argument was that they were put in that they would say, if they were asked if they were in a campaign stop and someone said, why did you do this? And they'd say, well, the alternative was to let it lapse. So the only thing we could do is make a constitutional version or it would have lapsed entirely.
And I agree with that, Josh.
Yeah. You're right. Their opponent would say, well, I would do something harsher. The problem with that is the court already said you can't do something harsher. So, you know, I mean, change an election, but I mean, the politician's in a terrible situation. It's not, you know, they didn't create it. I'm not sure there is a good answer for them in this situation, except delay, which you're right, is a possibility.
Well, I got an email from somebody last week that was confused that I was, so I tried to come up with an analogy about the situation because they were confused about our discussion. What I was trying to make as a point is that when you win litigation, you're not entitled to anything more than what you've won. And the best analysis I came up with would be in a boundary dispute between a couple property owners. We've got the Smiths and the Joneses. and the Smiths have encroached on the Jones property and built a structure. And the structure could be anything, anything from a barn to an outbuilding to a fence or whatever. But the Smiths have encroached beyond the boundary of their property line. So the Joneses go tell the Smiths, we'd like you to back off. And they say, sorry, that's our property. And the remedy is to go to court. That's what our system's based on, to solve disputes if they can't be resolved amicably between parties. And so there's a declaratory judgment filed, and the surveyors come in, and the experts testify, and the court finds that the Smiths have encroached on the Joneses, which is what happened in this law. The lawsuit was filed, and the trial court found that there were encroachments that the registry had encroached in areas that were not upheld on appeal. The appeals court decided that they had encroached by violating the ex post facto clause in 2006 and 2011 by imposing the proximity restrictions and by imposing the three-tiered different terms of registration and the enhanced version to comply with AWA. Well, then at that point that the court declared that they had been an encroachment in the Constitution, it's the same as at the property. When the court declares that you've encroached on the property, then the question becomes, what is a remedy? You can let the Smiths and the Joneses try to work out a remedy, which might include replatting the property and selling them part of it, maybe include renting it. It may include paying for an easement for 10 years. There's any number of things. So the Michigan ACLU and the attorneys preferred that there be an agreed upon settlement that would include a rewrite of SORNA. That was what they hoped for. And that's an admirable, it's a great, admirable wish. But you didn't win a rewrite of SORNA. What you won was that 2006 and 2011 amendments tipped a regulatory scheme to become punitive. So therefore, that's what you're entitled to if you force the court to grant you the relief that you've won. But they ask, and if you read the opinion of Judge Cleland on page 6, he says in July 2018, plaintiffs moved for partial summary judgment on the ex post facto claim on behalf of the subclasses. Remember, that's a year and a half ago. Plaintiffs requested declaratory injunctive relief, but deferred for later the briefing on question of SORA's amendments, whether they're severable. Deferred means they didn't want to rule it. While this motion was pending, the parties agreed to focus their resources on legislative reform rather than litigating severability. So the people who are cussing out the court for all this delay, the court was holding off because that's what the parties asked the court to do. The court was asked not to rule until the legislature had a chance to legislate. It would be equivalent to the Jones-Smith property dispute. Judge, you've given us our declaration that there's been an encroachment. Let us now try to work it out. And a judge will say, great, I don't want to decide what the remedy is. I don't want to have to order that structure to be torn down. If you guys can come up with a remedy, fine. But what the political analysis that I applied was based on 30 years of political experience. There was not a lot of incentive for the state to legislate, for the legislature to legislate, because the missing link is what just came to, the axe came down this week with, there's a date certain when the registry will not be enforceable. Up until then, there was 44,000 reasons not to enforce, not to legislate, because the enforcement was still taking place. Now there is a shift in the dynamics because the court has given them a date certain when you can no longer enforce this. That's what I was trying to explain. The plaintiffs are entitled to the relief they're won. They're not entitled to have a rewrite to their liking. If you're going to force the court to solve this, you get what you won and nothing more.
I don't think I was disputing any of that. So,
well, no, it was a listener comment. Why did the court wait all this time? The court waited because the court was asked to wait.
What about
just that simple?
Well, I mean, just a little behind the scenes kind of thing. I do think that there had been some pressure from. I think it was clear that the judge, as you just mentioned, preferred that that was the way that it worked out. I'm sure it was a little more, everyone was kind of working behind the scenes together to get that result, but you're right, it didn't work out very well.
And that's what the court mentions in the opinion, that the court deferred ruling, but for, let's see how they put it, the parties were unable to reach a resolution, and that's what I expected. That's not what I wished for, folks. That's what I expected, because politically, it's a lot riskier to do anything. It's now the court has forced their hand in roughly about 90 days. They're going to have thousands of people no longer on the registry, and they're going to have thousands more who have restrictions that were in effect. They're not going to be in effect. That's a powerful incentive to start legislating.
How about funny side friend, note real quick. There was actually again, behind the scenes kind of stuff, but you know, my understanding throughout the whole process was that they actually made a lot of progress on writing a new SORNA, and that all the people acted in good faith. And at least the story I've heard is that pretty close to the end, the governor's office just decided there was no political capital in it and pulled out their support for it, which is what Larry's talking about. But many of the people actually did negotiate in good faith, almost against their own probably best interest for a fairly long time. And I think a lot of progress actually was made, which might end up being helpful down the road.
Let's hope so.
For clarification, and forgive me, you keep saying 90. Is there a 90-day provision in here versus the 60?
Yeah, it's 90 because there's a 30-day notification period.
Well, and then the 60 starts running from when final judgment's entered. This is not final. This is an opinion. But the parties, the judge needs to issue a final judgment, and that is going to be negotiated like the previous one was with the parties. If you people can't come up with it with
Yeah, that's not my understanding, Larry. I think it's 30 days notification period, then they have 60 days to pass legislation or final judgment is entered. It's my understanding.
Brenda in chat said, what I keep saying is that I sure hope the advocates of various sorts are showing up and working with legislators to get a good rewrite.
I will say that, you know, the people on the ground in Michigan have been amazing. The little group, Michigan Citizens for Justice, which has about probably 30, 40 total members across the state, has touched every single legislative office in Michigan, has met with the lieutenant governor, has met with the governor, with the office of the governor. And, you know, so, I mean, they've been working their butts off to be present all over the legislature with very small numbers. And it's pretty impressive, really, what a small group of people can do when they put their mind to it.
What was I just going to ask you, Larry? Oh, how hard is it to take a comparison of a super benign registry and maybe like the 2003 Alaska registry, like kind of blend those together to make the quote unquote the perfect constitutional registry and introduce that? And does that give them enough political cover?
I don't think it does. Because people are going to look at the proposal, those who would like to be in office are going to say, Representative and Senator so-and-so is sponsoring a bill that would no longer require those on the registry to do these things here. This is totally dangerous, and this is going to put a big gap in our community safety. And I don't think you can propose a benign registry and not be attacked.
So it has to include all of the 1,000-foot restriction things and internet notification and.
I don't say it has to be. You asked me about a benign registry.
Yeah. But I mean, for them to propose one, then the opponents would then attack it as not being strong enough on these horrible people that have committed these terrible crimes.
I don't know where the magic line is where that they're going to get attacked, but a totally benign registry like I'd propose, I could guarantee you would be attacked.
Of course.
I mean, they're between a rock and a hard place.
Sure.
In a lot of ways. And whatever they propose is going to get attacked by the people running against them because it's like free money, you know?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they don't have to do something because the alternative is to let it lapse and then their opponent will attack them on letting it lapse. You know, I mean, it's zero sum.
I would like to get back to the question that was asked that I was cut off on to finish. Oh. I'm going to read from the opinion. Defendants will be permanently enjoined from enforcing any provision of the SORA against members of the ex post facto subclasses and will be permanently enjoined from enforcing the provisions described in Part 3B of this opinion against any registrant. The parties will immediately begin efforts to formulate a joint proposed form of judgment, which is what I was trying to explain, which will become effective 60 days after entry. So the court has to enter a judgment, which it hasn't done yet, and the parties are going to propose a judgment to the court. And then once that judgment is entered, the 60-day window will begin to count. Now, there is a notice provision, but Josh is right in there. But this case, their judgment hasn't been entered yet. This is an opinion. This is not a judgment. And that's on page 29 of the order.
Yeah, I'd have to go back through and look again, but I talked to a few people. I'm pretty sure that at some level, the legislator has a certain set amount of time before the opinion becomes essentially goes into effect. There may also be a separate thing, which is talking about how the parties can work together. And so I'll have to reread that to make sure I've got that right.
Well, I just read it. It's 60 days from when the judgment is entered. I'm guessing that the judgment can be finalized in 30 days. It could take 60 days to agree on the judgment.
Yeah, I think the judgment is supposed to be entered in the 30 days. I think that's part of the notification. But again, I'd have to reread it.
Well, that's where I'm getting the 30 days. I'm thinking within 30 days the judgment can be agreed upon. And what the judge is going to do is, if the parties can't agree on what the judge is going to tell each party, present your proposed judgment, and I will decide what the judgment says. That's what's going to happen. So, I mean, the judge is not going to let this drag out too long. He made that clear.
Can you give me a quick little splainer on what the difference, to me it seems almost obvious what the difference is, but can you give us what the difference between an opinion and the judgment is?
This is the underlying explanation of how the judgment came to be. The judgment is the actual order of the court. It'll be very short. it'll proclaim who won, and it'll proclaim what the relief is, but it won't be anything like this 32 pages we're reading now.
Yeah, I would say something like, hey, everyone, before April 2011, you can't have the registry enforced on you anymore. Everyone
Peace
after.
Out, bro. Yeah. So, but he's made it clear that they don't have a lot of time. And he made it clear previously that the delay is not, he's not interested in further delay. He's interested in the constitutional violation ending, because the Sixth Circuit said in their opinion, that it should cease and desist immediately, and it hasn't ceased, nor has it desisted. And this judge is ready. I don't know who appointed him to the bench. I haven't done any of the research on that, but clearly he's fed up with it, and he respects the Sixth Circuit opinion, and he's not going to let the state manipulate him any longer.
The craziest thing is, I don't know if the politics matters this much, is he's actually one of the more conservative justices in Michigan, and the Sixth Circuit, the person who wrote the Sixth Circuit opinion, is actually a very conservative judge too. So it's not, as Larry would say, an example of my liberal do-gooders doing their do-gooding in this instance.
You can't always count on liberals to do the right thing on this. They actually are dead wrong on some of the issues on this. They're big on the Me Too movement. They're big on a lot of things I disagree with.
He was appointed by Bush in 1990, Larry.
Okay, thank you.
How about if we could move on and zoom out a little bit? What does this do for other states, specifically in that same circuit? So this is from Will, and he goes, if the 1,000-foot rule is part of the constitutional issues with the Michigan registry, would that also apply to Tennessee if the restriction was found to be unconstitutional, not solely based on retroactive application that Doe's addressed? Would this apply to all of the Sixth Circuit?
Well, we've had this conversation before, and for the benefit of new listeners who haven't heard it, nothing automatically just starts. The way the law enforcement works is the laws in Tennessee are presumed constitution. So nobody in Tennessee is going to say, they can't do this in Michigan anymore, so we better cease and desist. They're not going to do that. But what this does do is it gives a person in the Sixth Circuit, and I believe Tennessee is in the Sixth Circuit, it gives them a controlling precedential decision to work from, to file a claim in Tennessee. Now, unfortunately, only the 2006 and 11 amendments, all the stuff that Cleland found in his most recent order, were not a part of the Sixth Circuit's decision. So the proximity restrictions were, but it would give you a good, strong basis to litigate, because the state of Tennessee would be put in a very defensive position, because they would have to somehow distinguish how the analysis would be different. So, as I've said many times before, Tennessee, you need to actually put together a legal team. You need to actually put together a plaintiff class. You need to actually put together a pool of money, and you need to actually litigate rather than wishing. You need to do some litigation.
I agree.
But having this as a feather in your hat as part of your documentation that you're pushing forth, I mean, like, this would carry a pretty large amount of weight, not as if it were from another circuit where it'd be just like, hey, they said this over there, but this would be like, we said this and we're part of the same area.
It would be binding if there was no way to distinguish, if they couldn't distinguish their way out of it. You're first going to try to distinguish your way out of it, and you're going to try to show it's different. If I'm the Attorney General of Tennessee, I'm going to say, well, yeah, we do have proximity restrictions here in Tennessee, but we only apply them to the level three offenders who've had a due process, and they've been adjudged to be more dangerous. Therefore, what Michigan was doing, they were applying these restrictions to everybody. So therefore, it's distinguishable. Well, we get a separate analysis. But if there's no way to distinguish their way out of it, the outcome is likely to be the same, because the district court in Tennessee is going to have to find that without distinguishable factors that they're bound by the Doe versus Snyder decision.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. That's a long period of speaking where I agree with everything Larry said.
How about moving forward and zoom out things even further and go out to the rest of the United States, where you have pretty horrendous registries? And I want to probably put Michigan in one of those categories, but, you know, most of the southern states are pretty crappy. What about, I guess the same thing that you just said about Tennessee is you got to put together a legal team, then you can throw this document in there as this is like a piece of the puzzle, and funding and attorneys and all that crap, and start running things up the flagpole in that regard?
That is correct. And this is enormously expensive. The state of Michigan agreed prior to the second round of litigation, to the Doe 2 case, they agreed to pay the University of Michigan School of Law and the ACLU of Michigan $1.8 million in legal fees. And right. I can absolutely guarantee you that they did not pay their team less. So this has cost the state millions of dollars. Now, Michigan's a relatively wealthy state, so if it costs $5 million, that's really a drop in the bucket to the state of Michigan. But the point I'm making is not so much about it being a drain on the state of Michigan. It's a drain on the law firms that would try to do this for you.
Of course. Of course.
They need money because this is going to devour their practice. On the Georgia case, which we're working on, there's an appeal pending because the Butts County Sheriff has the money, the limited resources to file an appeal. The legal team, I've got the brief that's going to be filed Thursday to be editing. They've got about 100 hours in doing that brief. Just that brief alone. About 100 hours worth of work between the two lawyers on our team.
And they get paid $25 an hour?
Well, they're not getting paid a damn thing until they win. They're not getting paid anything until they win.
I was being facetious about what the attorney's rates probably are, and it's not $25 an hour.
Well, no, I didn't catch. I thought you said $250 an hour. There was a bleep out. But NARSL, the National Association for Rational Sex Offense Laws, they put a little bit of money into this case up front to be a buffer against the total loss. But these lawyers are in this for well over $100,000, and this is just beginning, because when we win the 11th Circuit, when I've predicted, and I still predict we're going to win, the 11th Circuit's going to flush this appeal, and then we're going to have to go try this case on the merits. And then they're going to appeal again after they lose on the merits, because we've already got an advance opinion from the district judge that tells us that we're going to win when the case ultimately goes to trial. And then they're going to appeal again because they've only appealed the preliminary injunction. So they're forcing us to do a whole bunch of work. Point is, folks, get over your entitlement mentality and start contributing to the cause financially, because that's what it's going to take to move litigation. It's going to take resources. It's going to take lots of them.
I was going to go on a little rant about the ACLU, about something that you've said a bajillion times about, you know, how people vilify them for the various causes that they support. And here, this same organization is potentially creating a pathway for 800,000, 900,000 of us to have significant levels of relief, and they're in the hole for a couple million dollars, whatever, and every one of us needs to pony up some money to offset that and relieve that stress.
Well, now, in that case, that's not the case, because the state agreed to pay them as the prevailing party in those one. And I'm assuming in all the time that's been passed, they've collected that money. So, but suppose they had not prevailed. Suppose it had been the Fifth Circuit, like we just talked about with Estes Hightower's case out of Texas. Suppose they had lost after they invested all their members' resources into this, and suppose it had gone against them.
They would definitely not be interested in funding another challenge until, you know, if our people weren't supporting them.
Well, and most of our people don't support it. Most of our people are anti-ACLU to the max. But go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say, I do think that, you know, if nothing else, everyone who is on our side of the street, you know, should take the time to find a way to thank Miriam Ackerman and Paul Reingold, who's the guy at the University of Michigan Law Clinic, who've been working on this case pretty much nonstop for years and years and years and years. You know, I mean, Miriam works on other cases too, but, you know, she's taken this from the beginning and done incredible work. And so, you know, we owe her, a great debt. This is one of the biggest cases that's ever happened to reform the registry.
It's a fantastic win. I have nothing but praise for them. I have no criticism or second guessing. If they had asked me at the time, I would not have been as willing to wait for the legislative process to work because I did not have great faith that it would work. But they had very, very rational reasons for doing what they did. And the practice of law is you have opinions about the best course of action. I think I was talking to Brenda this morning or yesterday evening about the Georgia case. The appeal that's pending on the Halloween case, both sides, we're arguing the mootness doctrine, and both of us are right about the mootness doctrine because it all depends on the interpretation. And we're arguing one direction on the mootness doctrine, and they're arguing that this case should be overturned on appeal, that the injunction should be dissolved, and they're arguing the mootness doctrine from another direction. So I don't have any criticism. Nobody should take anything that I've said about criticism. I just say that politically, when you're expecting the political process to deliver for you, you're going to likely be disappointed because until public opinion shifts, it's not practical to take a posture to start dismantling the registry. It's just not.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, just to play a little bit of devil's advocate, and I was around for some of those discussions when they were happening. You know, I think that in the back of their mind was always that the best way to get Judge Cleland to actually force something was to go through this process. You know, I mean, I think they were hopeful that the legislature would do something. I don't know how much they really believed necessarily it would happen. They were hopeful.
Well, and I have nothing but admiration for what they've done. And right now, I think that if I'm wrong, I'll be delighted. If they come up with a benign registry within the time frame, I'll be delighted. But I just think the odds are not, if we look around the country, that's just not likely the way it's going to go. But I hope that I'm wrong and come back and say, gee, they surprised me.
Well, what do you think that, I mean, I think if they don't do anything, that works out pretty well for a lot of folks too. Yeah, but you think they're going to do something. You just think it's going to be worse. I'm kind of confused. Like
I don't think it's going to be worse. I think they're going to be just like Pennsylvania. They're going to try to reinstate as much as what the court declared unconstitutional as they possibly can.
Yeah, I think they're going to have a hard time finding courts that'll enforce that because it's pretty explicit.
Right. But it's presumed constitutional. So you have to wind this thing up all over again and you have to file a new lawsuit.
I don't know. I mean,
you can't presume it unconstitutional just because you don't like it. It's presumed
it's the same thing.
No, I didn't say it'd be the same thing. I said as close to what they would like to reinstate as much as they can. So what would be the difference if they said, Judge, you're right. You know, we have great deal of sympathy for the proximity restrictions. Say they peel off part of them. And not all of them. And say they take the street address off the registry and they just put 400 block of Eastern Southeast Grand Rapids. That is an improvement because it's a lot harder to know which house in the 400 block to put the projectile through. What if they did that? Then you have to go litigate all over again.
Well, I mean, they would have to do it in a way that answered the argument that was made about proximity.
Okay, well, part of the problems with the proximity restrictions, as I understood them, and we're going to go long and long if we keep going through this, but was the ambiguity and the unclear how to measure. What if they define exactly how to do the measurements? And
that would certainly help. Yeah, that would definitely make a difference.
and the property has to be used for the purposes intended. Like, say, if you have a 100-acre parcel, and the rather than being property line to property line, what if they say it's from the outermost property line of the sex offender's residence or where they reside to the structure that rather than to the boundary? Then you've got a brand new law.
I think that there is certainly a chance that with proximity, they could do something like that, where they actually decided what the line of find an objective line. I think they could probably do that.
And so
I don't think they can do that with all the things that have been, with certain, I think, it depends on who you're talking about. And this is why I said one of the options is that they could essentially let the thing lapse for people before 2011 and then try to rejigger as much as they could, and keep it like what you're talking about for all these other restrictions. Now, another option is they could try to do that for everybody. And I think that, that they'd get into a lot more trouble there. It would be a lot harder to pull that off with, ensuring that there was an enforcement. Given all the stuff Cleland said about the problems with enforcement of multiple different, where police, the vagueness problems that are created by the multiple levels of enforcement pre-2011, I think you get into, it's a lot harder for them to create something. They may do it anyway. I just don't think it'll be enforceable.
But again, it's presumed constitutional upon enactment. So they pass a bill,
and then it gets
challenged, but it's still presumed constitutional. You'd have to ask for an injunction. You'd have to wind up litigation all over again.
I don't think it would take long to get that injunctive relief in this instance, because it's one of those things where it's been tried and retried and retried to the point where all the judges are probably, I don't know. Maybe you're right. I could be just being naive. I don't know.
Well, we'll soon find out, but the presumption is that anything they come up with would be constitutional, and it would be a new complaint would have to be drafted, and there would have to be litigation all over again. And if you want injunctive relief, you would have to meet that burden of showing that you're likely to succeed on the merits, which if it's enough like this version, they would probably be able to do that. But what if there's dramatic differences, but it's still a registry that we don't like?
Well, I think that's probably going to be the case, that's probably likely. There's not going to be, as long as there is a registry, there's probably not going to be a registry that we like. I don't know about everyone in here, but I'm kind of opposed to the idea of registries, period. So
I'm all for it, man. Bring it.
So, if it got so benign, all you had to do is mail in a form every year, I doubt you'd find, and there was no picture of you, and there was no requirement you do anything else. I mean, that would be a minimal inconvenience in your life.
Sure. It would be much better, for sure.
So, and that would be a constitutional registry. But see, they're not going to do that because that doesn't satiate the thirst for vengeance that the population has.
Based on that email that post that person made.
Yeah. So that kind of registry would be tough to sell.
Well, that's a pretty good example of that post that you did of one of the things that I think that people in our community have been doing better, which is banding together to respond to posts like that. And I think you'll notice in the comment sections of a lot of things like that, where people have banded together, that a lot more and more people are becoming educated, and a lot more and more people are realizing that there are problems with these things. Now, you're not going to reach all the people, and you're not going to overwhelm all of that, but I think we're doing a much better job as a movement of not letting those things just stand.
We are indeed.
All right. Final tallies. Anything else anybody wants to throw out there before we close all this down?
I think we've done a good job, Andy.
I think so. I do want to announce that we have two new patrons. Larry, I've been forgetting a friend of mine, and he's going by No Soy Nadie, which for those Spanishly inclined, you know what that means. And then we also had a new one, Brent. Those are two new patrons that we have. So I want to thank those individuals, and also thank you to all of our patrons who generously support this podcast every month.
Fantastic. So we're closing in on the 100. We're only two away.
Only two, plus maybe a little bit more than that. Josh, as always, for joining. Who said something just there?
I said we're going to do that 100 before the year's out.
I think we probably could get there. Josh, how do people find you, and what do you have coming up? You have a new episode coming up. What is it, going to drop on Monday?
Yeah, the episode on Monday is about crimigration, the intersection between incarceration and immigration.
And, I can guarantee you that the transcription service is not going to know that word.
Probably not. Probably they don't know. Not. One of the saddest thing about the transcription service is that every single time it gets, it can't do my name at all. It never has been able to.
All right, then. It also had a terrible time with DOES, DOES being referred to in the case. It kept coming up with all kinds of crazy formats for DOES.
Yeah, you can find us at decarcerationnation.com or on any of the services, iTunes, Google, all that stuff. All the places you look for podcasts, we're there.
And you're probably not like trying to compete for space with the word Decarceration Nation either.
There is one other podcast that has the word decarceration in it, only it's decarcerated. So there's, it's a fairly small neighborhood for sure.
And you do a little bit of some Twitter and LinkedIn too, so people can find you there as well, right?
At Joshua B. Ho on Twitter. That's the best place to find me pretty much anytime.
Out freaking standing. Larry, anything else before we roll out?
That's it. And thanks everyone for the generous comments that we received last week.
Yep. And I hope everybody has a fantastic night and a fantastic weekend, and love y'all. And that's all I got. Have a great night, guys.
Yeah. Thanks, Andy.